You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Podcast Playground!
Hooray!
Welcome. You've arrived at the Taking a Walk podcast, where host Buzz Knight explores music history with industry insiders. This podcast can be found at Apple, Spotify, iHeart, the Podcast Playground, or wherever you get your podcast. Today, Buzz talks with record producer extraordinaire Jack Douglas. Jack is a legend who has worked with John Lennon, Aerosmith, Cheap Trick, and so many others. Enjoy Jack Douglas on Taking a Walk.
Well, Jack, how did you first know that music had sunk its meat hooks into you and would never let go?
I guess when I was about 4 or 5 years old, you know, my parents, they listened to a lot of music. They weren't musical themselves, but they listened to it. So there was always a ton of music in my house in the Bronx in our apartment. I was totally into, you know, getting like, you know, listening to how much is that doggy in the window. And I also loved, like, I mean, these are 78s I'm talking about. I also loved like all of the story books that came out, like Bugs Bunny or Steven and Tyler and I talked about this. We had the same collection of The Tortoise and the Hare and Bozo Under the Sea. That was a favorite of both of ours. So I was into music and storytelling at a very early age. And my dad, who worked in a freight yard in Hunts Point in the Bronx, he decided that because they had a nice console in the living room that they listened to their music on. My dad listened to opera, and my mom listened to what was then called race music, basically blues and R&B. So it was a good contrast. Plus, you know, the pop stuff that was on the radio at the time, Big Band and Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra and all those folks. But my dad got a hint that a train was coming in, and on one of the trains coming in from Chicago was a bunch of electronic equipment. And so, you know, they pilfered regularly. I mean, that was like part of the perks of working in a freight yard. And he decided that he was going to get me my own record player so that I could stop putting these records on their console in the living room. And so he went in the middle of the night and he got he saw Webcore of Chicago on a box, said record. He figured it said record player, so he stashed it. And he brought it home for my birthday. I think it was maybe I was six or seven, somewhere in there. You know, I don't. And anyway, he put it under my bed and then came in to wish me happy birthday. And he said, present under your bed. And I looked under and I pulled it out and unwrapped it. And both my father and I were like, what the hell is this? It was a tape recorder. It wasn't a record player. It was a tape recorder. A Webcore, a small one, and we got and we read the instruction manual, and we went down to Canal Street and bought a bunch of tape, and I started recording TV themes, which I really loved off the television. There were all these great themes. I Love Lucy and Abbott. You know, I remember every one of them so well. Abbott and Costello and the. I mean, all these shows, they're still going in my head. Highway Patrol, Dragnet. And I would record these things and listen to them. But I knew I was definitely into music. Also the thing that I noticed, and my parents noticed too, is that they would take me to see movies that were way over my head because I was a kid. But you went to the movies on a regular basis back in those days. And I could come out of the theater and sing the main themes to the movies, the melody lines, in the right key as well. So they kind of knew something was going on. And I would record street sounds. I'd hang the, we lived near an elevated subway, and I would record the train going by and feedback and all kinds of weirdness. I like to stick the microphone down my mom's old vacuum cleaner tube and record those sounds, and then listen to them back at the slower speed. And my dad once he said to me, I had these funky mono headphones on, you know, for like a radio. Anyway, he said to me, "What are you listening to?" One day, and I said, "I'm making my own music, Dad." He said, "Oh, let me listen." I was listening pretty loud, and he put them on. It was the vacuum cleaner. And he threw it down. He said, "That's not music." I said, "It is to me. That's music to me." And so he figured I've got this music thing going on. And maybe a month or so later, apparently a Silvertone Sears acoustic guitar fell off a freight car. And he gave it to me along with a Mel Bay chord book. And he said, "Now you can make music." And I learned how to play. And so I was in it from real early, and studied music in high school, went to a school that specialized in arts and science, studied theory and composition, and ended up playing in rock bands, and I was off and running.
You actually played in a folk band associated with Bobby Kennedy in 64. Tell me about that.
I was writing his campaign songs when he was running for the Senate. I mean, that was just an oddball thing. I was really young, 15 or 16. And I was doing the thing in the village, you know, where you busk in the street, or if you could get into a place where you didn't have to be over 18. So 18 was the drinking age. I would get in and play for whatever, you know, basically traditional folk songs, singing them. And this guy came up to me and he said, "Hey, you write songs too?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "How'd you like a job for the summer?" Oh, by the way, this particular guy came to a Young Democrats meeting that I was playing at. It was like, you know, at near NYU. So I said, "How much does it pay, this summer job?" And he said, "Well, it doesn't pay anything really, but you get to travel a bit and you'll eat and you'll have some fun." Well, that was... you know, playing these rallies for JFK. I actually ended up playing the last one at Madison Square Garden following the Ronettes. So, you know, one of my claims to fame is I played at the Garden, the old Garden. But I think that was the Democratic National Convention that was held that year. That was a good start for me. And I learned a lot about politics and turning traditional folk songs into campaign songs.
You've masterfully figured out the art of collaboration. Did you learn that when you went to the Institute of Audio Research there?
No. Not at all. Collaboration began as soon as I got my own rock band together. You know, it was not general. I made sure that the people who were in the band were real contributors, real creative, even though we were young. These were guys that had, most of them were a little older than me, but they all had good ideas. And then I went on the road after I came back from Liverpool. I went on the road for years and played with a ton of people, from the Angels, my boyfriend, back, and I would play either guitar or bass, play with Chuck Berry for a while. You know, I toured. I was on three different major labels, Columbia, Epic, and Bell, as a writer and as an artist. The last label that I was on was Teaneck, and my band was being produced by the Isley Brothers. And after that is where I made the decision to go to the other side of the glass and enrolled in the Institute of Audio Research, and also got a job at Record Plant as the janitor. They both happened around the exact same time. As my day job, I was a motorcycle messenger in Manhattan. I was living in the East Village. But that paid great money because I would ride that bike all through winter. And it meant that the nights I could gig with the band. So it was, you know, all I had to do was call up and say, the dispatcher, and say, I'm on. And I had this Norton Commando. And in the winter, I'd have knobby wheels on it so I could get around in the snow. And in the winter, it paid great money. So it was like really cool.
But when you became the janitor, you must have had your sights on becoming a recording engineer.
Well, I did. In fact, I wanted to be a producer as well, and a composer. And the funny thing was, while I was the janitor at night, I was also a client because I was scoring the original ABC After School specials for the producer Danny Wilson. And Danny's still active. That's great. But I went to work producing music for his show, which was called Over Seven, and it was the original ABC After School specials. And so at night I would be a client, and in the daytime I was the janitor. But I was, you know, I would beg other engineers if I could just sit in on their sessions so I could learn and I worked my way up from general worker. Actually, after janitor, you're just carting stuff around. And Record Plant also ran a school for us, you know, guys that were on the way up. So I learned a lot there, and I became a tape librarian, and I went into the editing booth. I was an editor. Then I was an assistant engineer doing tons of stuff, you know, working with great rock bands that were coming through Record Plant. And also early mornings, I was doing jingles for the Ford and airlines, and, you know, all those big commercials when you had the big orchestra dates and rhythm section. And I was also doing artist demos. So I did all of Billy Joel's demos for him to get his deal at Columbia. I did Patti LaBelle demos, and these were four track. So they would want to come in and listen to what it sounded like before they went in and invested in the big rooms to do it. And that's a great learning experience when you have to record all this stuff four track, especially if you've got a big rhythm section. That's, you know, I was in a hurry. It didn't take me long, honestly. They would let me at midnight, they would let me come in and record whoever I wanted for free, you know, like local bands. And, you know, I really made my bones by bringing in groups and recording them and learning how to do it right.
What a fascinating time it must have been in that area. It's still a fascinating area, that whole the whole scene. And since this podcast is called Taking a Walk, I have to ask you, even though we're virtual, so did you ever get sort of in a creative block where things were kind of jammed up, and would you just go for a walk in the village to free your mind?
No. No, I didn't have time for that at all. No, if I had a block, I had to work it out while I was at behind the board. But I mean, I made some terrible blunders. I was recording Patti LaBelle's demos, and a guy put these old boards, especially the four-track boards, were all tubes, and they had giant transformers and the bass player. And I thought, man, I'm doing this. This demo sounds so good because there's a full rhythm section. And her, and you know, I said, and you have to do everything live. You have to do your reverb or your compression. Everything has to be done on the fly right away because there's no going back to it. And so I'm doing this and I'm thinking, wow, I'm really good here. And the bass player came in. I couldn't wait to play it for Patti because I thought she's not even going to have to do a master. This is it. Oh. And the bass player came around behind me and he put his beer next to me. I didn't see it in the remote for the tape machine. It was in between me and the remote for the tape machine. And I went to hit the remote and hit the beer, and the beer went into the transformers and flames shot out. And literally I burned the board down. The flames were coming out of the faders. I destroyed the room. The board was gone. And, I got fired immediately. The owner, Chris Stone, came and said, "You're fired." Patti LaBelle went to him and said it wasn't his fault at all. And Roy Sakala, who was the chief engineer, quite famous guy, he was my mentor. He said to Chris Stone, he said, "Why don't we listen to the tape?" And because the tape was still there, he said, "Let's listen to the tape because if it's good, he'll make more money for the studio than that board cost," which was on its way out anyway. They listened to the tape, and the next day, Chris Stone called me up. I was like, oh, my career's over. How can I do this? This is terrible. Chris Stone called me up, and he said, "Well, we decided to give you another chance." And he said, "But we're going to give you a pay cut from $65 a week to $60 a week." I said, "Fine." So, you know, I got, but, you know, you trip along the way for sure, you know, but yeah, I never had time to go. I mean, for me, I was on the course that I wanted to be on. I was learning by working as an assistant, working on projects that had either lousy producers or really good ones. And I would be taking notes on this works, this doesn't work. And I was an assistant on American Pie, and I watched how all these bits and pieces of that song were edited together to make that masterpiece. And I went, that works. So, I mean, I worked with a lot of producers along the way as both an assistant and then as an engineer, which I became like the rock guy, probably because I played music rock for so long. But those notes really helped me understanding what worked with an artist and what didn't.
So as you were in that recording, you know, engineer mode there, I wanted to get your reaction to some folks that you worked with that were pretty amazing. I'm going to start with Miles Davis.
Well, I mean, first of all, he was great in the studio. Not at all, but he treated everybody great. The fellow musicians, the crew. Mostly I assisted on those sessions. I assisted on Miles. I assisted on Nina Simone because Jay Messina was the jazz guy, and Jay would always bring me in to do these jazz dates, Mike Maneri, the Brecker Brothers. And so I got to, you know, like be working hand in hand with him on these great sessions. But I was, you know, a giant Miles fan and a John Coltrane fan, and And I was, you know, I didn't know what to expect. You know, you always hear Miles turns his back on you, and Miles is, you know, Miles was the sweetest guy in the studio because he understood that in the studio, probably unlike a live performance, that is a collaborative situation and the crew is important. And so he was just really sweet, and he loved Jay Messina because they wore the same shoe size. and Jay would always come in with like a really cool pair of shoes, and Miles would say, "Jay, hey, Jay," I can't do his voice, but he would ask Jay to pick him up a pair of those shoes when he was at the store. And Jay would deliver him over to his brownstone on the west side near where Jay lived. But he was great. Nina Simone scared me. Working with Nina, I would be, you know, setting a mic in her pew because she'd be singing and playing piano. And she'd just look at me like, "Are you sure that's in the right place?" And she'd give me a real dirty look. And I'd go, "Well, I think it is." It's the fun stuff. Who else?
James Gang.
Again, I was assisting on James Gang's sessions. They were brothers. They brought the mother in one time. I guess they were from Indiana or someplace like that. The funny thing is, you know, I've become really good friends with, well, in the last few years, with Joe Walsh when I'm out in L.A. I see him quite often because he works with Ringo, and I see Ringo quite often. I got to talking to him, and I said, "You remember that album that you were doing at Record Plant, James Gang?" And he said, "Sure." I said, I was the other engineer. And he said, "You gotta be shitting me." "Wow, that's crazy." "Yeah." I said, "Yep, that was me." And that was Bill Simzik was engineer producer. I guess Bill went on to work with the Eagles. In fact, he invited me down to Miami to listen to when he had this motel that he had converted in Coconut Grove into a studio. He invited me down to listen to what he was doing. Yeah, that was fun. And those guys were very cool and very professional in the studio.
Another one that I love to mention is the one and only Alice Cooper.
Well, that was pretty cool because I loved working with Bob Ezrin. Bob was a funny cat. He is extremely talented musician and arranger and writer, and he was a guy that I learned both pro and con from, because his talent was so supreme that his ideas were always good, but there was never a lot of room for the band, in particular Alice's band, their ideas. It was like Bob laid down the law, and that's how you did it. And they were used to that, working with him. And so I thought, no, I don't think I can ever do it that way. But, and, you know, I'm not as talented as Bob, but I can work around it. But Alice sessions were great, and I worked on Schools Out and Billion Dollar Babies with Bob. And then after doing the Dolls album, the first album, Bob came to me and he said, "You know, because Todd didn't show up very much, and I had a good relationship with the band, we would keep that going." And Bob told me, he said, "You know, you're producing this now as well. You should be producing. And so I'm going to give you the next Alice album to produce because it's the last group album, and then Alice is going solo with me." And he said, "I don't like funerals, and so you're going to produce it." Which was Muscle of Love. They put Jack Richardson in there with me too to keep an eye on me.
And what would bring your first encounter with Cheap Trick?
I had relatives in Waukesha, Wisconsin. My brother-in-law, he said to me, "You got to come see this band that's playing at the Sunset Bowl, bowling alley in Waukesha tonight. They're really good." And I thought, God, my brother-in-law's taste in music is just terrible, but what the hell, I got nothing else to do. So we went to the bowling alley, and Cheap Trick was playing, and they were, I mean, they knocked me out. They were incredible. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And I had known about them because they were already making noise, not signed, but already making noise around the Midwest. I told them that right then and there. I said, I think I can get you a deal and I'd like to produce you. And they said, okay. So the next day I called up my pal at Epic Records and said, get out here and see this band. And if you don't sign them, I'll take them to RCA. And because my reputation with CBS Records, which was Columbia and Epic, because my relationship was good with them, he came out and they were signed shortly after to Epic Records. And shortly after that, I was out there. We did a quick pre-production. Mostly they had so much material. It was crazy. An insane amount of material. It was just a matter of making sure it was recordable, edited a little bit here and there. You know, it wasn't like I had to do any co-writing with them at all. They were really self-contained in that department. I didn't do very much arranging except maybe on the overdubs and things like mandocello. We knocked off, I think, 30 basic tracks in 2 weeks when we went into record play. And then I said, well, these songs we'll put on the back burner because I don't think they quite fit on this album, which the first album is a lot of social and political statements in it. I thought we're going to go to college radio with this, and we'll put these other ones on the back burner. I Love Go-Go Girls, I Want You to Want Me, Surrender. We'll put those on the back burner for the next record. Unfortunately, the next record, I was doing Aerosmith, You Draw the Line. That took a year to do, so I never got to the second album, which I had, and I didn't get back to them until Budokan. But that proved to be a pretty good 15 million records and still selling.
Tell me about your encounter with The Who.
Well, The Who were coming in to do, I think it was called the Lighthouse Project, something like that. And it wasn't Who's Next, but it was the material that was going to make up Who's Next. And so they wanted to record all this material, and they said, give us your chief engineer. They were gigging around the Northeast at the time. But give us your chief engineer. And so the chief engineer was a guy named Jack Adams. And he was not a rock engineer, but he was the chief engineer. He was an R&B guy, and he didn't like rock music very much at all. And so knowing that, they put me on the date to assist him. And so I see, the equipment came into the room, all Keith's drums, and I set up like I was setting up for a big rock date, like Mountain or one of those kind of dates where it's going to be heavy and loud and individually mic'd, all the tom-toms and stuff that Jack normally would do, because an R&B session is very different. And then the band came in, and I said, Jack Adams wasn't there yet. And I said, you guys want to roll something so I could get the room totally set up? And I said, sure. And so I rolled tape, and they started jamming. And they started jamming on Baby Don't Do It, Don't Break Your Heart. And I said to him, hey, do you mind if I get a friend of mine to come in and jam with you guys? It was Leslie West, who was in the next room. And so they said, no, we love Leslie West. So I went and I got Leslie, and he came in and he jammed. I think that particular jam session is available. Leslie West and The Who playing Baby Don't Do It. Recorded, it sounded really good. Sounded like The Who. I got it all tuned up. Jack came into the room finally. I love Jack Adams. He was a fabulous R&B guy, and later disco too, he did. But he came into the room and he said, oh, what is this? And I said, it's The Who. He's like, who, why, who? I'm like, the last album, Jack, was Tommy. It was unbelievable, huge. Wasn't into it that much. They came into the booth and they said, let's hear that back. what we just jammed, so we know what it sounds like. So got to spun the tape backwards, and they listened to it, and Pete went over and cranked it. Now, big Westlake monitors in that room, you know, 500 watts on each side. It, fabulous sound. He cranked the monitors right up loud, and I could see that Jack Adams was very uncomfortable with that, and he was like, "Oh my God, no, yeah." And then they went back out in the room, and Jack said to me, "I can't do this." Well, Kit Lambert was producing, by the way. It was a crazy maniac, but I loved watching him. I learned a lot. He would conduct the band like it was an orchestra, because his father was a very famous conductor in England. So Jack said to me, "I can't do this. This is awful. There's no groove. There's no soul." So I said, "Well, you know, you'll get through it, Jack. Don't worry." He said, "No, I'm not going to get through it at all. You're going to get through it, huh?" He said, "Yeah." He goes, "I want you to go into the production room," which was basically in the control room. There was a wall separating it. He said, "Call me up on the phone at the board and tell me something terrible has happened that I will have to leave." I said, "Why don't you just tell them something?" He goes, "No, I need to react to this." So Jack Adams lived on a houseboat and at the 79th Street Pier, Hudson River. So I called him up, and I was really quiet because you could hear me in the room if you cared to listen. And the phone rang, and Jack picked up. I said, "Jack?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I have something really terrible to tell you." Now, Pete Townsend was still in the room, and Jack kind of was obvious, and he was loud, and he went, "Something terrible? What happened?" Now, Pete and Keith are looking at him, and I say to Jack, "Your houseboat's on fire and it's sinking in the Hudson River." And then he repeated that. "My houseboat's on fire and it's sinking in the..." And then he kind of put in, like, in quotations, "I live in a houseboat." And then he said, "My dog." He didn't have a dog, but he threw that in for a little extra stuff. "I have to go. The other engineer will take over." I took the reins. The first song that we recorded was... "Won't Get Fooled Again," live vocals, and it was hair-raising. And we recorded, I don't know, 10 tracks. At some point, the front office heard that I was in charge, and they were a little worried, but they sent somebody down to keep an eye on me, and they sent me an assistant. And it was good. I got to be really good friends with those guys. And after the gigs, they would say, this would be like 1 o'clock in the morning, and they'd go, "Well, now we're going to go out and have some fun." "Okay, you're going with us, kid." "Okay." So I would go out with them, and we would meet at the Navarro Hotel, which was on Central Park South, small hotel, boutique hotel. They had the whole ninth floor, which was maybe 8 rooms. This way, it kept them away from, you know, regular clients. And Keith and Pete had the 2 front suites, which faced Central Park. Beautiful. And on the 9th floor now, this is a building that had high ceilings. And so I would go there, and we would meet in Pete's room and then go out to some after hours place, or just, you know, they knew all these spots. I was a New Yorker. I had no idea these places existed. You know, they get a couple of limos and off we'd go. But anyway, every night I would go up there. Everybody came through the door into Pete's suite, but Keith would open the window on his suite and crawl across a ledge outside the building and then open up Pete's window and climb in. This is like 9 very high floors. And no one thought that was unusual except me. Everyone was, "Oh, hey, Keith, what are we doing tonight?" And I'd be like, "Oh, my God, great." That's a little bit. I ran into Pete at SIR at a rehearsal just a few years ago. He was coming to a meeting, and he had a girl with him that he was producing. And I ran into him. I said, "Hey, Pete." I mean, it had been years. I said, remember me? And Jack, and he goes, yeah, Jack Douglas. Oh, yeah, wow. It's been a lifetime since I've seen you. And I said, yeah. And he introduced me to the artist that he was with. And he introduced me. He said, 1,000 years ago, he said to her, we worked with Jack and made him famous. Thanks. Thanks, Pete. Thanks. It's true.
It's outstanding.
Yeah.
So then it's 1971.
Well, 69 is when I went to Record Plant. So the very first project, interestingly enough, that I worked on as a general worker, because we had to move tapes, was Woodstock. Can you imagine?
Wow.
So the van would pull up with the tapes from the show that were recorded live, and then I would bring them to the various studios where the artists were fixing the tapes. And you ran into Hendrix and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. They were all in there. It's amazing. I'm like, wow, I'm in the right place here. But yeah, go ahead.
16. Well, excuse me. 71, you would engineer Imagine.
One of the engineers.
Yeah. Tell me about your first of a lifetime encounter with John.
You know, I was an incredible Beatles fan. Had been for years. I mean, just short of fanatic. Really loved them. I even went to Liverpool in 65 on a tramp steamer and bought Rubber Soul the week it came out. That winter, November, December, bought it in Liverpool. I got deported for a lot of reasons, for playing in bands without a work permit, from escaping from a ship, blah, blah, blah. I made a lot of noise, and I was in all the newspapers. And even in the Mirror in London, I was stories about my adventures. But I was on the front pages of the Liverpool newspapers, in particular the Liverpool Echo, which is the big newspaper in Liverpool. And I got deported in chains, mind you. Really, they wouldn't take any chances that I was going to escape again. And that was in 65. So now, go forward some many years, and I'm at Record Plant working. And John is down the hall in another room with everybody doing overdubs. And, you know, working on Imagine. He'd come over from England where they'd done a bunch of tracks. And now they were doing some more tracks and doing all the overdubs. My job, because I was a good editor, was down the hall in another room, small room, was to edit these some of these tracks and prepare them for multi-track, because they were on 8 tracks and they wanted to go to 16 tracks. There were handwritten notes from John, you know, don't edit the masters. Make sure you edit the copies that you're going to make. You're going to edit here. Anyway, I was hearing most of the album before anybody else was hearing it, because I was editing and transferring. About 4 or 5 days into this whole project, the door opens and John comes into the room. I nearly peed myself because I didn't think I would be having contact with him. I just thought, I'm good enough having this gig as an editor. And he sits down. He says, okay, if I hang out in here, so I'm just looking for a place that's not so noisy. I knew he was, and I figured he was trying to get away from Phil, who had a terrible reputation, Spector, that is. And so he sat on a couch on the other side of the console. So I only could see his feet up on the glass and cigarette smoke. And I said, I'm editing your stuff. And he was like, yeah, okay, thanks. You're doing a great job. He just kind of blew me off. And he sat there and smoked. And about 5 minutes into this process of me working quietly, I said to him, I've been to Liverpool. And his head popped up. And he said, really? He said, where are you from? And I said, I'm born and raised in New York City. So why would you want to go to Liverpool? Everybody there wants to come here, including me. And you know, it's not a great place, not a tourist place. I said, well, I was a musician and, you know, I really wanted to swim in the Mersey. I wanted to know everything about the music scene there. And which was really cool because I got to hang in the original Cavern Club, which was an amazing thing to do back then. So he looked at me and he said, well, how'd that work out? And I said, well, good and bad. I said, bad, I got deported. But good, I made a lot of noise before I did. And he looked at me and he said, were you one of the crazy Yanks that was in all the newspapers? And I said, yeah, that was me. This was me and my buddy. I talked into going with me. Yeah, another guitar player. He said, you know, we looked at this pictures of these two guys on the front page of our newspaper the week that we put out an album that should have been just us all over the front page. Here's these two Yanks making all this noise in Liverpool. And I said, yeah, that was me. And he said, and in one of the pictures that was on the front page was my guitar, Les Paul Custom. He said to me, right away, he remembered that because that made an impression on them. He said to me, you still have that Les Paul? I said, no, it's a long gone. He said, I can't believe it. All the places I walk into, and there's this guy I'm meeting now that was someone that, you know, we laughed about, you know, in Liverpool and did all this stuff. He said, what are you doing? I said, like I said, I'm editing your stuff. He goes, you're an engineer. I said, yes. He goes, okay, you're on the project. I said, Yoko is going to know that there's some deeper meaning in us meeting you. You know, after a session or two, he said, where do you live? And I told him, in the village. He said, we do too. We're on Bank Street. Let me give you a ride home. And then one time on the way down to the village, he said, you know, any place where we can get a late bite to eat? And I said, sure, I know a million places where I can get you in a back door. And suddenly he asked me for my phone number. He called me up, said, listen, I have to go to this party and there's going to be all these people there. It was Abby Hoffman and that crew. He said, just come with me because I don't really know them and you can watch my back. Started hanging with him and we became friends. And then he said to me, listen, I want you to do these Yoko records, okay? So I met with Yoko and she said, what makes you think you can do my records? And I said to her, because I was really an avant-garde John Cage fan and all these avant-garde jazz guys. And I said to her, because I don't care if when you play the piano, you're inside it or outside of it. And she said, that's good. That's good. And so I did just all these records with her. Sometimes John would be producing them, or he'd be sitting next to me while we did them. It was a good run with her. And because of that trust, that's why I ended up producing, because they both trusted me. While I was doing the Muscle of Love album, we were out in L.A., which he told me to do. He said, come out to L.A. You're a producer. You can do it wherever you want. And Warner's is in L.A., so bring it out there. I'm out there. It was his last weekend. And so I became one of the original Hollywood vampires. I was doing that in Alice, too. You know, I frequently drove the getaway car. That was my gig, get them out of trouble. Interesting. And had a long, long relationship with him. I miss him. And I think the world would be a different place had he lived.
If you could describe his creative process, what would it be?
He worked on songs for months, if not years. He had a germ. He would work on it. And you know, when you see that film, he brought the Jackson film. He brought stuff to the studio to work on. Here's something I have. He always was preparing. He was always writing. I mean, some of the songs on Double Fantasy were years old that he had demoed numbers of times. And so he was well prepared. The thing that he had no patience for lollygagging in the studio, you know, which is why he hated Phil. Phil would want, you know, 50 takes. Whereas for me, and I would always have him do live vocals, frequently within the first five takes you had it. And he knew it, and I knew it, and the musicians knew it as well. It wasn't, and I was always a step ahead of him the whole time we were working. And so he loved that. He liked to be, you know, somebody was always prepared for him to do what he had wanted to do. And I think that's why we got along. I in the last few years before he passed away, I became very good friends with Jeff Emmerich. And he would be over at my house for dinner. We would do mixes together. We had a lot of time. And we talked about John. And he said to me, I wish I knew the John that you talk about, because he knew the angry John. From the, apparently, he could get very angry. And the Beatles, I know that alcohol didn't was not good for John at all. It was kind of, he would get angry. That I saw while we were in California. He was just just amazing that whole summer we were working on that record. And then later into the fall while we were doing Walking on Thin Ice.
You ran into these guys from Boston in 74 named Aerosmith. How many years were shaved off of your life from beginning that ride with them?
10 years. 10 years were shaved off my life. Not those years, but later years. I mean, I'm 30 years sober, but there's a lot of, you know, as their drug got used, years got worse. I mean, I was always like the straight guy. You know, I thought to keep this session together. When it was over, when the session was over, maybe I'd smoke a joint when it was over. But, as the drug use got worse, they exposed me to a few things that later in my life became a problem. And then, I lost some time, but none of it while I was working with them. No.
How often did crisis management enter into your job description working with them?
It depends on what you call crisis management. Get Your Wings, Toys in the Attic, Rocks, they were all really creative periods for the band, and they welcomed my input so that I was like a member of the band. We did months sometimes of pre-production, and it wasn't until we were doing Draw the Line that it became a problem, because they would stay in there. We were in a nunnery upstate New York, like Westchester County, actually. And they all had their own rooms, and frequently some of them wouldn't come out of their rooms for 3-4 days. That was the crisis. As far as working with them or having fights or not so much, no. I've always been the good politician. You know, my thing is listen to the band first. First of all, you know, my job is to make a band's dreams come true, you know, not mine. And, you know, they understood that that's the way it was. And so, although we didn't have to talk about it, that's the way I approached all of that stuff with them. We worked hard together. You know, I mean, sure, Stephen would come in and say, I could sing that better. And I would say, I don't know if you can. But if he said he could sing it better, I went with it.
You co-wrote Kings and Queens, didn't you?
Yes. But you see, that's at the point where the band wasn't writing. I mean, I contributed a lot as a writer previous to that. But I always thought that's my job as a producer. You know, people told me many years later, that was a big mistake, but I don't think so. Because now every producer is a writer. You know, it's like that's where you get your publishing and blah, 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 blah. But at that point, I had to start writing because they were losing their productivity. But I like Kings and Queens. I think it's cool.
Oh, I love that one. I love that tune. That's a great one, but so many great ones. Oh, you know, being in Boston for so long and part of the Boston scene, you got a big fan of Aerosmith right here.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm still a big fan. The Peace Out tour should be interesting. When they were doing Vegas, the residency in Vegas, my son was in the band as a percussionist. My son Colin is a Latin jazz guy. A couple of Grammy nominations as a jazz artist, but Joe liked to work with him on his solo stuff, and so when they did this residency, he wanted him to play all the tambourines and congas and bells, and so that's what he was doing. He could sing too.
So what are you working on now, Jack?
Geez, So because I have a label. Yeah. Well, the first act that we signed was the Detroit Youth Choir. And they, of course, were huge hits on America's Got Talent twice. They were huge hits. And so I produced that record in Detroit called Rock Spell, I called it. It's a Detroit rock band with its youth choir singing classic R&Bs. It's available on our site. And then the next artist I signed was Robin Taylor Zander, who's Robin Zander's son. That album is out now. We just dropped an acoustic version of High and Low, although the single version of it is already out. And the whole record is available on every platform. Detroit Youth Choir won us a gospel about 2 weeks ago, won us a gospel version of the Grammys for the record that we did. So that's pretty cool. And last week I was in Los Angeles talking with Disney, because Disney has picked up the Detroit Youth Choir for a miniseries called Choir. And so we have the record and they have the miniseries. So it's could be a good combination. I've been doing a lot of film scores. I've got on Personality Crisis. I just worked with Maurice Scorsese and Ron Howard on Personality Crisis, One Night Only, which is on Showtime now. I've got two films going into the festival circuit that I composed the music for. One is called Trust and Love, contemporary rom-com, takes place in Malibu. And the other one is the Carol Doda story, which is a documentary about the first topless dancer in San Francisco, which is cool. I just last night watched the completed film with my score in it. It's pretty cool. It's amazing how much footage they have of that period that she was, you know, what was happening in San Francisco from 1964 through the early 70s. A lot in San Francisco was amazing. And then I've got an artist named Ellie Lowe that is, I'll be in the studio in Los Angeles with her this coming month, producing her. She's really amazing. She's out of Atlanta. And then my partner on, we have two labels under one umbrella. So I have Confidential Records, NewYorkCity.com. NY, that's Confidential Records, NYC.com. It's a good website too. And my partner under the same umbrella is Make Records. And he's a little bit different than me. He's signing members of Ghost. And he's got a group called Silver Plains. It's a little harder rock than what I usually do. Well, I produce outside acts. I have a request for a group in England called Xander and the Pirates. I may do it. And I today got a message from a guy who has, since we were speaking of the Who, has the license for all of this. He has all this Ant Whistle incomplete material that the family has licensed to him to complete. So that could be interesting. I started listening to it today. You know, that's keeping me very busy, all of this. I mean, the label keeps me really busy and on the go all the time. You know, people said, well, you know, why don't you retire? What am I going to do? You know, I'm qualified to be the bag boy at Stop and Shop. Even though right up on the wall up there, you see John Jack Douglas, Doctor of Music. There it is. I got it right up there on the wall. But that'll get you a bag boy job. And now there aren't any bag boy jobs because it's all automated and you got to pack it yourself. So I would basically be unemployed. So I like what I'm doing.
I am so grateful for our friend Drew Lane for connecting us out of Detroit. And so glad that you've been on Taking a Walk. Thank you for the stories and for the music, Jack Douglas. Amazing.
You're very welcome. Good to see you.
Taking a Walk with Buzz Knight is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts,
or wherever you get your podcasts.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.